one of the senior guys did something that in the practice effectively meant I failed, got a bollocking off the coach, got kicked out of the practice for a while. I'm going, wow, that's what this is. If they'd got one pass, which we were not in control of, if they got one pass and scored in the corner, we lose, they win, would I be equally as proud? Absolutely. It wasn't about winning for England and building the team. It was about, can I stay in the team? Can I keep getting picked? I found that really unpleasant. I wanted to build an environment where we're putting on the England shirt, instead of it making you play smaller, play within yourself and think about all the outside stuff, is it makes you feel bigger, makes you feel stronger, it makes you feel more determined if you possibly can be.
Into the final moments, Alex Payne trying to keep this side going forward. Haskell takes it on now with just relentless chat, largely about himself. And there's Tindall to add the finishing touch of glamour and World Cup winning stories and a slightly sideways nose. That is how you podcast. A dominant display by the good, the bad and the rugby.
Hello, Dream Team. Welcome along to this week's The Good, the Bad and the Rugby in partnership with our very good friends at Continental Tires. Hope you're all well. Good to have you with us once again. We have a very special guest for you this week. And I think it's probably fair to say in 99% of introductions, we would welcome him as the England head coach and we would discuss team selections and results, etc. But this is GBR and we like to try and do things a little bit differently. So this week's show is more about the man behind the badge. A man who made his professional debut at 19, his England debut at 21. He won the Premiership and the Challenge Cup. He won the Six Nations as a player and as a coach. And with the clipboard, he's overseen the game's greatest ever upset with Japan beating the box in 2015, the Lions drawing with the All Blacks in 2017, a Tiger Premiership win in 2022, and a bronze medal for a gutsy and unfancied England team at last year's Rugby World Cup. Steve Borthwick, welcome to The Good, the Bad and the Rugby, which is not a sentence I thought I'd ever get to say, but I have. It's very, very nice to have you with us. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you, and thank you very much for having me here.
Does this feel a little bit like almost having to wait for an injection? You know you've got to do it, and you know that it's sort of a bit of an uncomfortable experience, but there might be something that comes out at the end. Is this a little bit like sort of one of those, or is this for you? Why GBR?
I think if... it's because of Hask, obviously.
For sure.
Obviously.
Yeah. That's the reason.
It's good to have you.
Because we actually realised, we were just talking off air, that for a big chunk of it, not club, but I was with you in the England career, weren't you? You saw me come and go, and I saw you come and go, really. So, I mean, there's so much to kind of talk about in between. I'm very excited, because also, it's not many times you play with someone, or you're captained by someone, you play with someone, you're then coached by someone, and also two very different personalities that actually got on, because you never think me and Borthers would get on. And we weren't nightclubbing together. I did try to convince him to do that a couple of times, but it was absolutely none of it.
Do you want to second that you got on, or you're welcome to put in a different opinion if you'd like? What was he like as a young and up-and-coming, noisy tearaway?
Noisy. Hask was brilliant. In any team involved with, I could talk about from being teammates, where always brought a smile, always brought enjoyment, always lifted spirits, always brought energy, and that's essential in any team. He probably plays down is how hard he worked to get better. On the training pitch, he was phenomenal, the intensity he trained at, staying on the pitch afterwards, doing pickups, doing extras. And there was a fair amount of secret training he did as well. There's a lot of stuff. And I reckon all the top players. And same when I arrived as a youngster at Bath, and the team had won the European Cup the year before. And great, there was a lot of players sort of at the tail end of their careers. And I remember then seeing as a youngster, these guys, how much training that the top guys did. The away from the club, away on their own, they went and did more. And I used to see it because I used to go and do it. And Hask was the same. And I think all the top players go that bit further, go that bit extra. That's exactly what Hask did.
Thank you again for coming on. Have you had a bit of downtime post Six Nations? Have you done Speedos and Lilo and been reading a bit of the book? Or has it just been proper debrief, non-stop, the wheel keeps turning?
Yeah, well, it keeps turning. And I think we've had some great rugby to watch, study. We've got plenty of great players to be looking at. We were touring Japan and New Zealand this summer. So straight after the end of the Six Nations, just traveling across to New Zealand to do the recce of there, check out all the training grounds and everything we need over in New Zealand, and then back doing the reviews, the Six Nations, catching up with all the head coaches, DORs around the country and watching plenty of rugby.
Have you popped a note to Eddie and said we'll have a little sake when we're over in Japan, or is it battle lines drawn because it's a significant test for both?
So I was in Tokyo in January, shortly before the Six Nations, and Eddie and I had coffee then, caught up for a couple of hours and talked a lot of rugby, which is great.
Interesting.
What do you do in your kind of spare time on those moments? Because I always got into habit now where audiobooks or, you know, kind of reading or watching movies while I eat, I don't really switch off, because I always think if I'm wasting my time doing something else, I could probably do it more useful, because you're always watching rugby and coaching rugby. How do you let your hair down? Because I remember Eddie had this sort of like his mad work ethic, but on the plane, his laptop would be upside down, his glasses, and he'd be asleep, and he'd walk past him, he'd be like, fuck, he's actually sleeping, but no one would say anything, because he'd be like watching video after video. But obviously that's not possible. When you do these trips, do you unwind, you watch the movies on the plane, like do you read a lot, or do you try to switch off? Because to be a good coach, I imagine you need good balance from just focusing on the sport versus focusing on other things. I know you've got family as well, obviously.
People talk a lot about work-life balance. Well, I'm very, I've been very, very fortunate in that my job is something I love. I love coaching. I love being with the England rugby team. So I take a lot of enjoyment out of it. So for me, it's about life balance. I've got a young family, so spending time with them, spend time with my boys, those things. I read a lot. I think, you know, I read a lot, but very much then I find the stuff that I read is very much geared towards how can I be a better coach? How can I lead my team better? But I take great enjoyment out of that. Gives me a lot of energy.
You haven't got like a secret habit of like Only Fools and Horses or something like that we don't know about, or some sort of like really irreverent comedy that you're into, something like Harry Potter fan or
Sex
something.
Sex in the City, that would be a curveball.
Yeah, no, none of that.
No, none of that. Usually a bit like yourself is that when the TV's on, it's usually something the boys are watching.
Right.
So it's usually a Star Wars movie or something like that, which is, I love Star Wars movies, so that's a fine. Usually first thing in the morning, it's training, the exercise where I'd watch something during that period. Again, it's something I find interesting. I was watching this morning the documentary about the Patriots, the dynasty.
I've heard that. It's apparently unbelievable.
So I read the book, and now there's the documentary series. So watching that, I find really fascinating.
Would it be fair to say it's been a hell of an 18 months since you stepped into the role? And when you talk about, you know, your boys and family, etc., do you find it very easy when you go home? I mean, you talk a lot about the studying and the continual improvement you're looking for. Do you find it very easy to sort of switch off and suddenly you're putting the bins out and you're reading bedtime stories and you're making packed lunches, etc.? Or do you find the pressure that comes with this job bleeds into home life as well? How easy is it to turn off the day-to-day?
When you're doing something you really care about and really enjoy, it's not about turning it off or switching it off. I think any coach who really wants to do well, they all often talk, the phrase is used a lot, is you're there, but you're not there. That's what a lot of coaches will say. Again, I'm real fortunate that I go home and I got a family. Suddenly I'm from coaching, I'm then having to be tackled because they want to practice their tackling, or I'm in goal because they want to practice their football and the penalty goals, or some such thing. You know, that's, or they're doing judo and they need somebody to pin. You know, that's me. I walk in the door and that's what you get, which is brilliant.
Do your boys love what you do, or do they have absolutely no interest at all?
They love rugby, and that's the thing. It keeps reminding us about what this sport can do, what sport can do, in particular the sport that we're involved in, rugby. They absolutely love it. Love learning about the players, watching the players, trying to copy their kicking styles when they're kicking for goal. You know, you see all the kids line up before, as they're about to start training. They're all, I was watching them yesterday morning, they're all trying to practice seeing some goal kicker that they've seen on TV, that the role models they follow. Today, probably starting to get some comprehension. Obviously, love the England team. I was asked a question by one of them, asked me, are you famous? You kind of, because it's them, it's just your dad.
Yeah.
You're their dad.
And the answer was? Global, son, global.
You know, you're driving the car and you're driving to school or something, and you come on the, you know, you start hearing my voice on the radio because I've just done some interview or something.
Put your highlight CD together.
Let them listen to this, whatever you do.
And I'm as quick as I can trying to turn the volume down, and they go, that was you, why have you turned it down? You know, so there's kind of those surreal moments like that. So I was thinking, you know, I'm just
I'm their dad.
It must be quite nice as well with your partner as well. You sort of come back and say things haven't gone that well at work. You come in and sort of there's no time to mope in because you've got to be a dad and you've got to move on quite quickly. I think sometimes that's quite nice. Like a supportive partner kind of knows, yes, fine, but you're here to be a father first and foremost. That must be quite nice to move on quite quickly. Or does she allow you time to sort of
she helping
stew?
With team selection and breakdown angles?
Yeah,
it's exactly that. And I think throughout my career, I think you've been similar. You've always had interests outside of rugby. Yeah. Mine somewhere be associated with rugby, but outside from seeing the benefits when I left school, I started studying for undergraduate. Later in my career, did a postgrad, did a master's, things like that, and always been involved in things outside of rugby. I've always felt they've always been things in some way have helped my rugby, but even just having other bits to focus upon has always been beneficial.
Can we talk about you as a player? And actually, just before we do, because when we started, before we recorded, I said, you know, these are things we'd love to get into, and you said, talking about myself is possibly my least favourite thing or worst side effect. Why? When I sit opposite a man who loves talking about absolutely nothing else but James Haskell in the singular, you've achieved so much in your career and there's so much more to come. And yet I think a lot of people would know very little about the man behind the player and the coach. Is there a reason for that?
I don't think so. I think that rugby's a sport that has all kinds of different characters within it, players of different shapes and sizes, and there's a place for everybody. You know, contrast here. You know, this is the case.
You can't find two more contrasting people.
That's a good word, isn't it? Contrast.
Yes.
You know, I was actually thinking about probably with some questions in advance, was thinking about the different environments you've been in, the different types of characters you've been involved in. And I went back to actually a time I was at Saracens as a player. One thing I felt they did super well is treat everybody equally but differently. They had a place for every character of the just everybody was embraced. I remember this one time we went on one of those trips, and it was a trip to some ski resort. I forget where it was. They roomed me with Skulk Brits, like some sort of cruel joke. And you know, Scarlett, very similar. And I love Skulk Brits, very, very different to me. But as a character, he brought such enormous energy. And the day would start, I'd found a gym so I could go and train early. He was having a lie in, and then there'd be breakfast together pretty much as a team. And then he'd go off on the ski slopes all day, which I had no interest in doing. I'd go and find a nice cafe to sit in and just relax for a day, and then catch up at dinner in the evening, and he'd talk all about how he'd gone off piste or wherever it was in the ski slopes, you know, gone some ski. And then we'd have a sort of great chat around dinner, and then he'd go off somewhere else in the evening and have a late night. But then could always come together. That's the thing about rugby, is it has this incredible blend of characters as a place for everybody. You know, there are people who are loud and extrovert, and there are people who are not, and that's all right.
And have you always been that way? Because, I mean, you know, you read about your early career. Even as a youngster, you were picked out as a leader and someone who, you know, pulled the entire team together on the field. But were you, I mean, not necessarily shy and retiring, but were you sort of an introvert growing up?
I think when it comes to rugby, that's different.
Yeah.
You know, that's you bring every aspect and fiercely determined to win. That's where I always have been. I always had to work exceptionally hard. First, when you're a schoolboy and you go to those trials, you remember those trials you used to go to? And like you go to the first regional trial where it's just a small group of schools effectively competing against you to try and get onto the team, and you don't get picked. And you're right, okay, this is, I'm going to have to fight my way through this some way and find a way into the team, find an opportunity. That was ultimately a fair way through my career. It was about fighting and working as much as you possibly could to maximise every opportunity I could get. Now, so let's be clear, is when it comes to preparing a team, leading a team, when it comes to finding a way to win, like that's all, and that's different.
Yeah.
I mean, obviously, there's more sides to you than two, but from what I'm hearing, what I saw as a teammate, as a friend, and as someone you coached, there's kind of Seaborg the family man, the kind of quiet guy, but you're very competitive. You know, you were quite vocal on the field back in the day, weren't
push
you?
Push that. Good. Use the line that you've said in the past whenever I think shithousery was the word that came out quite a lot.
You liked to trash, you were a bit of a trash talker on the field. You're like super competitive. I mean, I got visions.
Is that
of,
fair or is that unjust?
I think when you were...
he's deep. He's going into the media handbook. Yeah.
I think that when you're trying to compete in any way you possibly can, trying to find a way to win. Now, I wouldn't necessarily agree with all that, but were you always blessed with the team best players. No, you've got to find a way to win in some way, shape, or form. That's when it comes to match day. That's where it's focused upon.
What about pushing my head in the mud and telling me I was rubbish and that the stupid for giving me a penalty?
That was just as a coach, wasn't it?
That was when I came in this morning. Yeah.
I think you've always got that competitive gene within you. And I think that's now having the opportunity to coach, it's as close as you can get to playing.
Yeah.
But I think why coaching and why take this role is one of the things is I like helping people. I got to captain a lot of teams over a lot of years. I like helping people. I take a great amount of satisfaction and enjoyment from helping people achieve what they might not have achieved without some help, trying to help people maximize their careers, maximize their potential. And the second thing is, I think as a player, and I dare say you'll say the same, is you make a load of mistakes.
Yeah.
And if you're going to help people in the future not make quite so many mistakes, if you can help them avoid some of those traps you fall into, then that's something I also want to do. I think my team know how much I care for this team and the players that are within it. They have everything in me. Couldn't be more committed to them in that regard. And then the side you're asking about, do I then need to see my name or hear my name or hear me talking about? No, I don't. I really don't. My ego doesn't need it.
Do you, in a world that we live in now where some of us are Instagramming our breakfast, our lunch, our dinner, and every left and right footstep that we take throughout the day. Do you see now more and more of a need, though, particularly as you know, rugby faces the challenges that it has, that actually there is a bit more of a requirement for that from not everybody, but from certain people in certain positions?
Yeah, I see it with my yesterday. I say that I was at that mini rugby and seeing the kids trying to emulate all the players that they look up to, seeing the effect that the players have on the next generations down. And that, I think we all have a great responsibility. Rugby's got some challenges. Mm. And there's lots of people employed in this game, lots of people around this game, and we want this game to thrive. I think it's a fantastic game. We all have a responsibility to help that. And my primary responsibility is to build a successful England team and help these players thrive. And I think we've got a fantastic group of players who I want to really do all I can to help be the best they can be.
Yeah. Going back to when you started and I suppose the environment that you stepped into, how different was the England team that you stepped into relative to the one that you're in charge of now?
The first time I went into an England squad, it was in 2000.
Mm.
And seeing this setup, seeing the excellence that was around it, the environment, from there till about 2004, you know, I played some games. I made my debut in 2001. My first tour was in 2000. But realistically, like, I picked up a handful of caps. I don't know how many for the first few years, and you kind of almost observing and seeing this and trying to compete to get your way into this squad and seeing this excellence that had just been created by Clive and his coaching team that was so set up to be successful and win in 2003. It was brilliant. If you look at that, then English rugby the last 20 years has effectively not been able to emulate that, such a limited number of championship wins in that period of time. And I think part of it was the environment then was so good, and some of the other environments that we've been part of. I was thinking about it just the other day. I remember going into rooms where they'd have an exam paper face down with a pencil. Do you remember this?
Yeah.
And you're all individual desks because you've had to study all the plays and you've got to fill in all the plays, but not just your role in all the plays, everybody's role. You need to know everybody's role. I don't know your role, you need to know my role. I'm observing this and the stress that it was causing all the players trying to study and things like that. Seeing the way it used to be where I used to walk in and the newspapers were on the breakfast tables, you know, and I'd see coaches reading the scores that had been given to the players out of 10, you know, those things that were doing. I go, ended up with this environment where, and the team changed and tactically it changed. And you go, and I end up this feeling that the players always looking over their shoulders. Am I going to be here in the next game? Do I get blamed? Did I do enough to get picked next week? And it wasn't about winning for England and building the team. It was about, can I stay in the team? Can I keep getting picked? And I found that really unpleasant. I remember this one meeting, I was there with the coaches and there was a few senior players and coaches there. And we obviously had a chat senior players beforehand and gone through what we wanted to get, messages we wanted to get across. I speak and put them across.
What was in there?
There's things, and you, I know you wouldn't want me to be divulging, you wouldn't expect me to be divulging the minutiae of the conversation. And then waiting for everybody else in the room, all the other players to join in, sort of back it up, and didn't. And I went, well, 10 minutes ago, we were having a conversation, we were all in, and now, and I remember reflecting on it and thinking to myself there, that if it then comes to the key moment, and even internally, and the players don't back each other, and the player, we can't just have a proper conversation with the coaches, and I go, even senior guys, I thought, even they're looking over their shoulder, they're worried about this, and I go, how do we expect on a Saturday to go out and be all into a game and just commit everything, be so clear-headed in what we're trying to do, and just clear-headed with all our energy invested in playing super well for England. So what do I want now with this squad? I don't want them to have those experiences. I want them to enjoy this experience of being in this England team. I want to enjoy maximising their potential, enjoy pushing their boundaries, enjoy the experience, enjoy the challenges, because we've got some great challenges ahead of us. I want them to love it. Does that mean we're going to win every game? No. But do I think we can, if we have that attitude, we'll keep embracing every challenge and keep getting a bit better? Absolutely.
How would you describe your England career now, and how shaped are you by it in what you're doing today?
I would, and I've said this before, it's not new, I look back with a whole load of regret. You'd like it to be different.
You know, I've said this, and obviously Steve will always be much more sort of media savvy than I will be. I had, I think, five England coaches, and four out of the five were the worst, some of the worst environments I'd ever been involved in. It's probably shaped you quite a bit, hasn't it? Because it certainly did me. Now in later life, when I sit through business and meetings and stuff with people, I always recall those times. What was a good environment? What was a bad environment? And they were pretty bad environments, I think.
I think how we can always improve it and make sure that it's right for the players. And that changes over a period of time, because the players now, they're you know, different personalities to what it was before. I think, and I'll say that, you are always very, very welcome to come into England. And I'm serious to say that, because in my experience, very rarely did I ever see like former players around. And like, even in the change rooms at Twickenham now, like there's a board where former players can come in and sign where they are on the board. Like, oh, actually, there's pictures of them, that guys that have helped this team where this team is right now, and people who are maybe outside of it now but are part of it and always will be part of it. They will always be such a positive influence. And Johnny, I know he's not here today. Johnny was in the change room after one of the Six Nations game. Courtney was in the change room. Mako. People can come in, sign the board, always be part of this team. And that's what I'll say to these players, that your picture's up on that board. So waiting for
what's
you
something
to,
written over the top of
so
it.
I can only imagine the graffiti.
I'm waiting for you to come in and sign it.
I would love to sign it, yeah.
So that then, and even something as simple as that in the change rooms after the game, for the first time ever this Six Nations, is we've been allowed to get all the families into the change room, and people can actually finish a game and actually celebrate and be with people who've helped them be there, and the kids can see it. And it's certainly something nice is that coming into this role, my family has to be part of it. Like, it can't be the way I've had it in the past, where, you know, there he is, I'm off to work and there's home. Like, the family have got to be part of this. So, and as I talk to the players and the senior players, and I think you can see from my selections how much I value experience and the leadership those experience figures give, is the legacy they have is what they leave behind in the people. Those players I just mentioned, they've left great things in the team and in the people in this team. So if I can keep doing that each player has their time in the England team, adds, builds, helps others, and make sure the team is in a better place, those guys will always be part of this team going forward.
I don't know if you'll agree with this, but I kind of know that the truth, it depends where you want to go with it. Obviously, when you were with England and...
As a player,
you were kind of stitched up towards the end, told to go and get surgery as a chance to get fixed, and then were never asked to come back when you were told that you were going to come back, from what I know. The way I've seen you treat some of the players, like Danny Care with his 100th, and guys finishing and doing it in the right way and giving them the right time to play, how much did your experience with that shape the way you treat these players? Because in certain professional sports, people say there's no room for sentiment. I completely disagree. I think, especially a traditional contact sport like rugby, there's doing the right thing and doing it in the right way and giving people opportunities. And you've done that unbelievably well, like, to compliment, because, you know, a lot of people don't have those opportunities. Did that moment with England and the way you finished, is that one of the regrets that you have, and the way you retreated, and now does that really shape how you treat these players?
Well, I think all those experiences inform you, and that's one of them. But there's a whole host of experiences, and I've changed a lot. If I go back to, like, when I started, 98, I left school and went down to Bath and joined Bath. At that point, Bath were a team that was, them and Leicester had been the most successful team over that, the teams over that period of time, and it was a tough environment. It was one where, and they would openly talk about it, we're going to make it so tough here that if you can survive training, then you're going to be a really good player. That's what I walked into. And you know, at the first bit, you don't quite grasp it. You don't quite know that.
Who were the worst characters when you stepped into a professional?
Was John Hall there?
Jerry Gusker.
I'm not old.
Hawley
had retired at that point in time. So
who'd have been in there? Nigel Redman?
The team at that point, and not answering your question, just simply saying what the team would have been at that
okay.
point in time.
He's good, isn't he? He's very good.
Mark Regan, Andy Long, hookers, Victor Bugu, tired, Ollie Redman, Martin Haag, Ben Clark came back shortly after that. Richard Webster, I think, was captain at that point. Catty was there, Jerry, Phil de Glanville, John Callard, Addy. It was a good team.
That's a good
team. Wasn't Richard Webster, was he really tough?
No,
he was a very tough
There's
man.
Some story about him, absolutely. I think either he got knocked out or him knocking someone out. Apparently he was like real.
Lovely man. Like, so you're tough on the field.
Right.
But he was brilliant with the youngsters. Like, he was brilliant with me. I didn't have a car. He was the guy who'd pick us up, and he'd be the one who'd offer to take you back home and stuff like that. You know,
really?
He's in his 30s and I'm 18 years old, and he looked after the younger guys in the squad. It wasn't like that throughout, where it was this tough. I remember this drill. We did it at the rec. We're training out the back of the rec. Some drill where, you know, obviously all the players knew this practice. I didn't know it, new to the squad. One of the senior guys did something in the practice. Effectively meant I failed and got a bollocking off the coach, got kicked out of the practice for a while. I'm going, wow, that's what this is. Seriously, that's what this is, where you're going to try and do that. All right, that's what we are. And that's what. And then I was a product that for the first, I don't know, 2-3 years thinking that's the way this is. And realizing, actually, it's not now. Things have got to be different.
Is that what you mean? You forged that competitive, like, because obviously you've gone into a training session, someone's completely stitched you up. Was that a point where, obviously the competitive element was there, was that a point where the other side to Steve Borthwick was born?
I think the competitive side always there. I think what that period of time and the reflections on it and taught us is about supporting people and helping people. I think our responsibility is to help others.
But they were stitching you up.
That's the environment it was back then. And for a while there, you think that's it, because you've only been exposed to that one. And then you start thinking there's got to be other ways to this. So that one of the aspects of change, and you talk about the way you treat people, you mentioned DC and keeping it very simple. I like to keep things as simple as possible. Treating people how you'd like to be treated yourself. Do you always get right? No, we all make mistakes. And is the times where you apologize and times you ask for feelings? Oh, absolutely. But humble enough to know when you got it wrong, vulnerable enough to say you got it wrong and model that behavior. Yes, definitely. And so do try and treat not just the experienced guys, but throughout the squad. And I think that's, I don't want people looking over the shoulder. I don't want people living with anxiety in them. Like, there's a certain level of performance stress, performance anxiety that's optimum for the players to perform. And you go, that's different for every player. But loading more anxiety, getting people thinking more about other stuff than just simply winning. Just go out and play as hard as you can. Bring all your skill set on it to try and win. To try and win for the team. That's all that matters right now.
Have you got a little black book of people that you wish to apologise to you?
I'm sure you have.
Do you know what? I'm better than all of them now, so I don't need them. No, I just wonder whether they're... Because you said about their kind of regrets. I imagine they weren't all game-related. I imagine they would have been experiences like you're talking about that you would probably...
There's plenty of them. And every one of us has them. And I remember I said earlier on, I was the guy who went to the first trial and didn't get picked. And then thinking, right, I need to prove to this coach. That throughout my career, you're always working and fighting for the opportunity. And sometimes you're getting picked and sometimes you don't get picked. Sometimes you carry it with you And I'm sure you both know where you carry it with you. Someone handpicked you and you're holding on to it. After a period of time, you're going, it's one person's judgment. It's, you know, somebody wants to say something about you. Somebody wants to say something. I know myself pretty well.
Yeah.
And I spend a lot of time just understanding myself and trying to improve myself. There's nobody outside who understands me as well as I understand myself. So most of the time, they're just irrelevant. And an outside noise, again, with this England team, let's just, it doesn't matter what happens, it'll always be outside noise. It's just, let's just concentrate on what we're doing and the way we're going about things.
If you were to look at that the career, what you did actually do, when you sit back and you're in a completely different guise, you're helping other people, do you have an appreciation of what a career you had? I'm not saying you have to go around and celebrate, you might not tell everyone, but do you now have the ability to go, while I have some regrets, there is some satisfaction in that? Or are you still... just is the overarching thing, the regrets issue.
Do you ever look back at all? I mean, do you have Premiership winner medal in the sock drawer or an England shirt on the wall? Or is it just done for you, what you did as a player?
No, it's not, because it's part of the experience. It's part of what's informed us. And I think, as I put here, it's helped inform those good bits. Like when I think back to what the England environment was that Clive built, along with all the people that he brought into that team, that's informed my view of things. You know, that first experience I talked about at Bath, that's informed it. But then also had some wonderful experiences at Bath and seeing the excitement, the passion that gets behind rugby when people galvanise. When, you know, I remember when I decided I was going to sign for Bath as a schoolboy was the morning of a European Cup semi-final where I'm walking through town in Bath as a 17-year-old, 18-year-old, and thinking, what, this place is electric. To then those experiences at Saracens, just a completely different environment, which was wonderful and celebrated people. From those moments where we won that first Premiership Saracens won, and we were defending on our own goal line for I don't know how many minutes, past 80 minutes, and to win by, I think, 4 points. And understanding then that we were one pass away from us losing, and reflecting in that change room and going, this is amazing. I'm so proud of these guys and everybody who's played a part in this Premiership. And also understanding, if they'd got one pass, which we were not in control of, if they'd got one pass and scored in the corner, we lose, they win, would I be equally as proud? Absolutely. Absolutely. And a point I think you probably only get late in your careers is probably, it's only then when you start realising those kind of things. My final game was the Premiership final at Twickenham, and we lost at the, I think it was like the last play of extra time. Went to the TMO or something like this, and we ended up losing. I remember stood waiting, like, I've got no control of what this TMO is going to decide. I'm proud of what the guys around me have done to get to this point. Absolutely. But I remember at that point, after that game, it's the final game I played, there's a gym beside the changing rooms at Twickenham. Beth and Hunter came, Hunter's only little at the time, came in just to see us. I'm finished as a player now, and that's it, it's done. At midnight that night, my contract finishes and I'm no longer a rugby player, which has been, for the last 16 years, I've been the rugby player. Just spending time with them, and Hunter picked up this rugby ball. I remember him, he walked over. I didn't know quite where he was going in this gym, just watching him. And I didn't see that one of my teammates, one of the young teammates, was lying on the floor in the corner, just kind of gutted. And Hunter went over with the ball, because what does he want? He wants to play. And he wants you know, team to play with him, you know, chuck the ball with him, and he started really, you know, this game where you want the boys to go and play, and I really want these boys to bring now. So the, going back to the environment I want to create is one where we're going to do all we can, we're going to work as exceptionally hard as we can. There's going to be some heartbreak, like getting within 2 minutes of being in a World Cup final. There's going to be, you know, the last game against France and the Six Nations. You're 2 minutes towards beating France in Lyon. And there's going to be some heartbreak. There's going to be some really great moments, but we're going to learn. We're going to learn fast and we're going to enjoy the journey.
Every week we'd like to do a little section called the Continental Tires Question of the Week. Now, normally our social media team would put out the guest is coming on and the question would be put around there, but we didn't want to put that out there to spoil the surprise. So the question we have is, given the state that the England team was in, how big a decision was it to accept that England role? Because it's hard. Like, I reckon the second hardest job in sport is being a rugby coach behind being a football coach. I don't think people really appreciate just how, you know, how much the job is about probably coaching versus media versus everything else. Everyone always thinks it's just
engagement,
you know,
and grassroots.
Yeah, yeah. There's a lot more to it than that. I mean, was there a moment where you had to think long and hard about it? Because most people would jump at the chance, but having had your experience, I can imagine you'd have to take a bit of a pinch of salt.
It wouldn't be right to say you don't think through in terms of decision making process. You know, this is shortly before a World Cup. There you go. Right, there's not much time to get prepped for the World Cup. There's a load of players unavailable through injury. You're trying to, where I need to change the coaching team. I need to find some coaches. Can't, for the first Six Nations, I'm not going to have the coaching team. So I'll then get the coaching team for the World Cup. Just about, won't be fully together, but we'll get the team just there. You then say, but we've missed one tournament of prep. We only got one tournament and then a couple of games before the World Cup. That's all we've got. And you're saying, and we're not going to have the coaching team together for that one tournament. And it wouldn't be right to say, did I not sit there and go through all the pros and cons and unequivocally, even with all the different aspects and the things you've discussed, is yes.
Yes. Now you've listed all those things. I don't know why we ever question. Why would anyone ever question Steve Borthwick's resolve when you list the challenge you took on, the coaching staff issues, the things you've had before? Just believe,
trying to make a cake without any ingredients.
That's what I mean. Just believe in Steve, and because I think most people get rattled.
There's a hashtag right there.
Believe in Steve.
Or if you can have that one for free.
I just imagine it's just interesting. Like, you know, there's always a plan. Like I admire your ability not to be rattled and to stay level. I think it's one of the most brilliant skills because you need emotion, especially when we know the emotion's in there because of how competitive you are. It's very interesting. Maybe when you die, medical science can like dissect your brain and work out how that ability, or
whatever it is you're drinking. If you could share it with your friend alongside, that would be really really helpful for all of us.
I think the privilege and. With the privilege, there's always certain other responsibilities or costs. You know, the privileged opportunities we have, like to be involved in that World Cup, to have got in such a short space of time, to have got so close, to have gone down, you know, to like the boys winning in Cardiff last year, and it was England's record there in the Six Nations, not been great. To go and win in Cardiff, in the manner they did with different things, that was terrific. To have won against Ireland, to have got so close, those incredible highs. There's going to be pain along the way. That's inevitable. And I think as you talk about leadership, there's a coach in America talked about this, and they talk about the costs of leadership or the downsides of leadership. There's different things such as being misunderstood and not having the chance to explain yourself, not being able to. That's it. To trying to do the very, very best you can for the many, which means at some point you're going to hurt a few.
I'm going to ask it, but I imagine this might be delivery that goes straight through to the keeper. But the Andy Farrell in the tunnel, I think he said, "How are you, Steve? It's been a while." Did you confirm or deny that? What was that about? Was it something that had happened?
No, it was something nothing.
That was competitive,
really.
Steve. Coming
That's competitive,
out, wasn't
Steve.
It was something or nothing. And I think I had the great privilege of coaching with Andy on the Lions in 2017 and seeing, and I was coached, I was still a player when he was coaching at Saracens before he left and joined England, and seeing what a phenomenal coach he is, and the job he's done at Ireland is superb. Look at the team there, and I'm sure next year we'll do a phenomenal job and hopefully lead a very successful Lions tour.
I was going to ask, you know, when we said about the two sides to both, how as a coach you manage the really competitive side? Because for example, I had Michael Checker at Stade Francais, and he, fair to say, I think he had one side that was quite aggression. I don't think he was necessarily, he went mad, pushed the cameraman over a wall when we played against Harlequins in the European Challenge Cup. Because you are still that fiery kind of win at all costs person, how hard do you have to manage that? Or is it okay? Do you keep a lid in it? It's not a problem. Or do you feel it like coming out? Because I've retired. I do find it hard to keep a lid on it sometimes.
Red Hask is never far away.
Yeah. I mean, we had an incident where we're in Hong Kong at Sevens, and there's film crew filming us, and a bloke walked down and just bumped me straight into the corridor, and obviously my whole demeanour slipped, and I obviously had a conversation with quite clearly.
He then came up and said, "Hey, don't you play for Exeter?" Yeah, and Hask was like doubling down.
Yeah, and Alex was
not
like,
good.
Alex was just shushing him, like, "Just leave him alone." I just wondered with you as a coach now, how do you manage those? Because sometimes people know how to push your buttons, you know what I mean?
I think one of the key things is always asking is what the players need. And I think that as a coach is central question to what you're trying to do. And then, so what do the players need from you on any given day? And it's my responsibility to deliver that. So we talk about this Six Nations, going from Scotland to Ireland, those 2 weeks post it. Now, we didn't get together for a few days after the Scotland game because we assembled in York on the Wednesday. You could sense, which happens with the England team, you could sense the feelings the players had felt over the scrutiny that had. They were worried going into the review. I knew there was whispers of, you know, am I going to get a hard time in this review? I could sense people were starting worried about their place in the team. Probably all emotions that we can remember. Yeah. I remember as this review, and you go, this is what we've got to do better. This is where it went. For 20 minutes, we played pretty close to how we wanted to play. And then made an error, and then led to another error. And the only time there where with the players, they would have seen me emotional regarding it, if that might not be the right word, was the fact that I felt the players, when they made an error, started taking themselves out of the game and started playing small, and the shirt started weighing heavy on them. And they started playing in a manner that wasn't the way we were going to play. And it's like tried to play in a way that was safer, further from the game line, passing earlier, running sideways, and trying to be safer. But actually, that's riskier because we hadn't practiced like that. The bit that annoyed me, it wasn't the tactics or anything like that. It was the fact that under pressure, we started playing small and we started leaving the fight. You've got to stay in the fight first and foremost. This is test rugby. It is tough. It is hard. And the players in that review would have been the fact that they started doing things they wouldn't do. And they started going into rooks. That's just taking you out of the fight.
So you don't care. You're not worried about the mistakes. You're not worried about, it's about the endeavour and doing what we talked about and the execution as opposed to.
So George Furbank made an offload late in that game. And it was a great decision. It went to ground the other players weren't wanting an offload because they didn't want to have the ball. You've got to want to have the ball. Yeah. And so saying that the bit about that reviews, the guys gave in to whatever that was outside and started thinking about the results, started thinking about what's going to happen in the future, thinking about selection, thinking about getting criticised, thinking about all this stuff. And I'm going, all that stuff is making you play smaller. It's making you go within yourself. It's making you leave the fight. And you can't leave the fight. You just can't. No. So then there's that to deal with, you know, the selection thing. And I don't know how many changes I made between Scotland and Ireland. I don't think it was very much. Mitch came back to fitness. I think George Martin had come off the bench in the Scotland game.
I think Manny Feobosa started as well, didn't he?
Because he'd come on and done so well. And this England squad now, and I've said this to them, I want to build continuity within this squad because we've got to build a cohesion. I can't have people looking over the shoulder. So we've got a squad of 36. I'd anticipate that by we get to the World Cup in 2027 is that there'll be maybe 26, 27 of these guys, maybe 20, I don't know exactly. They're going to be there then because we've got some players that are maybe more experienced who maybe won't make it. But anticipate the other guys being each squad and building relationships with each other. And again, do I think there's going to be some tough moments? Absolutely. But one thing that you've got to do is you've got to fight. And you can't, you know, you've got to, I want to build an environment where putting on the England shirt, instead of it making you play smaller, play within yourself and think about all the outside stuff, is it makes you feel bigger, makes you feel stronger, it makes you feel more determined if you possibly can be, so that suddenly it galvanises the group. I'm sure you can relate to
that.
Yeah,
100%. I just wondered as well, do you feel like that's quite a hard thing to do, especially with England, because of how much you kind of have to unwind with the media scrutiny, with kind of social media now? Because, you know, that's a challenging thing. I remember playing for England, especially in those bad environments we talked about. It was hard enough because the coaches, I didn't think, were great and the environment wasn't great. That's one thing. But you get double the scrutiny here with media. You get double the scrutiny, you know, with social media. It's quite a hard job to be able to do that. So, I mean, is everything you do geared to trying to make sure the lads can do that?
How big a challenge is it to keep clear heads in a world in which everyone is able to send a direct message with their often unhelpful thoughts?
Well, I think one of those things is understanding that the noise is there. I suppose one thing we'll establish here is being involved with England is great. I'd rather be involved with a team that has a lot of people watching, a lot of people interested. I'd rather be involved in that than a team where that sells that ground than a team that doesn't.
Yeah.
That no one's really interested in. That's clearly I'm really proud Englishman, and I want to help this team win. Just to accepting that is part of it. Now, so different bits. One, I'll talk to the team. You know, when the England team lose, everyone talks outside like the world is ending. When the England team win real well, best team in the world. And I choose to follow a different path, which is somewhere in the middle, which is one of just, let's get consistently better.
Can I ask you, and again, I know this is a hot topic at the moment, about the overseas players. And you've had a bit to say about that, particularly off the back of the Investec Champions Cup this week and Jack Willis's performance for Toulouse. A lot of people are having a lot to say about it at the moment, particularly as more and more players head to France. Is this a conversation you're having ongoing? Is there, would you be given like a couple of wild cards that you can use, or is it just one that is a shut door for the foreseeable?
The decisions has been made. What I said this publicly before is we've got to create a system in England, the clubs to be so good, the national team to be so good, the pathway to be so good that players don't want to leave. And that's our job. If we create the framework and the rule that players we pick from England, and we've got to have the best competition in England. We've got to have the clubs thrive. And that's what I want. I think that's what we would all want. We all want our best players playing in England. So always building a system that makes them never even want to look overseas. Mm. Just they want to stay here. That's imperative, I think.
I'll take over the RFU if you want to change the rule. If Bill swings up.
Arthur Daly.
Yeah, exactly. Get me in, I'll fix it all.
Can I ask you just about a couple of key members of your team as well? So we run something called the British Airways High Flyer of the Week, which is our tribute to the England player who has stood out. And I think we've done 10 of them, and Ben Earl's won 6. He's won so many, we've actually had to exclude him now so that we get to share the competition prizes.
He's flown around the world 85 times.
I know, exactly. But, yeah. I think he's won himself a couple of BA sandwiches. But just, I mean, the progress that he has made and the form that he is in right now gives you how much satisfaction?
I'm so happy for him and all the work he's put in. And your last Six Nations 2023, he and I had some challenging conversations. And to his immense credit, and he worked hard with the coaches at Saracens and drove his game forward. I think the other thing that needs to be recognised here is that I think what was his first 15 appearances, I think, were off the bench. Mm. And some players jump in and the first test, and then they're flying from there after an international rugby. There's other times where you give the players some time. And sometimes that happens by just circumstance, availability of other players, and then a player starts taking their opportunity, has a run of games. Sometimes you stick with players and they grow into those test match animals. Some embrace it straight away, some grow. And then again, going back to the scrutiny the team is under, part of my job is to ensure that the players can grow, have an environment to grow. So Ben, the way he is developed, and I don't know how many tests is now on a run and he's played and started, and how well he has played. And there are other players we could list in that regard. That comes back to this continuity and cohesion. That's all about it. Comes back to the plan. Comes back to understanding where we're going. There will be bumps in the road, but just keep getting a bit better every single day.
And the other one who we hear a lot about, and obviously we have on the show regularly, is Ellis. And just the emotional energy. I mean, you obviously won the Prem with him, which we haven't really touched on. Can I just add very quickly on that? I remember when Freddie Burns drops the goal and the full-time whistle goes. Again, it's not just in press conferences. What was your reaction at that point? Because you barely moved. I remember that very clear. It was a very, very considered. You just sort of sat and drank it in for a bit.
Yeah, I mean, you want to capture those moments. I think we talked about this. You go through a lot of your playing career and don't. And to have that ability to capture, I don't take for granted the privilege it is, whether you're coaching at Leicester Tigers or England or anywhere else, to be able to sit in that chair and see players do what they do. Players pour their hearts out on the pitch.
Yeah.
Players give everything themselves. You know, Ellis that day just gave everything of himself on that day, and we had to take him off because he'd taken an injury and he couldn't keep running. He was trying. He didn't want to come off, but he was trying. Freddie Burns, who'd been through, he's such a talented player and had some tough times and some great times. He was out in Japan and had called him and tried to persuade him to come back to England. And he's going, well, it's pretty good out here. I'm enjoying it out here and I'm having a great time out here. And you, why? And I said, just come back and be part of what we're trying to do. And he did. And he trusted me to come back. And he did. And he came back. And him to play that part, to also see that George Ford, who'd played the way he'd played all year and then go off after 20 minutes, he was over the moon for everybody as well. That is a moment as a coach where you can see these boys that have just done so well. And I mentioned, you know, Peter Tom, and you know, he's in tears because just the moment. I said before, I like helping people. I like seeing people be joyful. I like seeing other people have joy. If you can help in some way, shape or form to bring some joy, that fills me with enormous satisfaction. So being able to sit there and reflect on that is important.
I wonder what would happen if and when we win the World Cup, the camera pans to Borthwick's. And it just explode, like disintegrate, yeah. or like
the ultimate is achieved. Goff
just puts a sequin jacket on and just goes completely mental. Yeah, would have just stopped like that. Both is, are you right?
Just imagining what it would feel like. It's a fast forward to play some small part in helping the England team win that World Cup in 2027. These players, many young players now that can grow to be a champion team. The older players, the most senior players, some of them might not be there in 27, but are going to leave a legacy in these younger players. They're going to be represented on the pitch. And understanding that the England team going forward will always be representative of all those people who've tried to add to the team, like yourself. I tried to add to the team and want to support the team. And then they go onto that pitch. You know, so when they're pulling the shirt on, they're not feeling the weight of the past. They're feeling the energy of everybody that wants them to do super well, everybody who wants them to succeed. They're feeling all that incredible positive energy. Also, that comes back to the type of environment we want to create. Don't get me wrong, like, it's demanding. It's demanding. It's test rugby. It's a demanding environment. It's one that's demanding in a positive manner, one that wants to bring energy, that help people. I saw that with the supporters in the Six Nations. I think Jamie led the team incredibly well. And the players played with such heart. And the biggest lesson, never, ever play small. Never, never, never play small. All the outside stuff tries to get you to play small. Play big.
Yeah. How much are you looking forward to this summer?
It's an overused word. Excited to take the team to Japan and then down to New Zealand. We've got some different challenges and it's what a brilliant time to try and prepare the team for this. That we've got the last part of this season, this Premiership season, and Europe with clubs represented in Europe. Hopefully it's a tremendously successful end of the season with lots of players playing well, hard-fought, tight games, test match games. I would love that if these were games, because, you know, test matches are so tight, they're nip and tuck. And you can see that by Ireland, we win with a drop goal. France, we lose with a penalty goal. South Africa, we lose with a penalty goal. Test rugby is nip and tuck. So this end of the season, I think, is really exciting. Then we go off to Japan, and we're playing in Japan at the end of June. It's going to be hot. It's going to be humid.
Do you greet Eddie with a nod, a handshake, or a hug?
It'd be always a handshake, so we'd always greet each other. And we play in Tokyo, and for a lot of players, that'll be their first time into Japan. For several of them, it'd be a return from 2019. Mm. Conditions will be hot, it'll be humid, and then we're flying down to the Southern Hemisphere. We fly down to New Zealand, and the first game's in the Forsyth Barr Stadium in Dunedin under a roof. So again, different conditions there, and then we're up to Eden Park. You know, so we'll be in the midst of the New Zealand winter there. So it's an incredible tour. I think it's been a number of years. We were there in 2017, obviously, but it's a number of years since the England team have been down to New Zealand. We went to Japan in 2019 and for the World Cup, but to go over there and play a test match over there in the National Stadium, which is an incredible stadium. It's an exciting summer, and I think the players are excited about it. The players enjoy these experiences, playing in these great stadia, in front of these crowds, with the challenges we face against different opponents. Figuring how, you know, if you look at this last 18 months, as you describe, we've played just about every team in the world except New Zealand. We haven't played New Zealand yet. We've played Samoa, we've played Fiji, we haven't played Tonga yet. We haven't played Australia yet. So these are all challenges that you know, we've got New Zealand this summer, we've got Australia in November. Mm. So it's brilliant. And I think you see a lot of quality teams around the world as well.
Last question, which is, it's been, as you've mentioned, it's been a hell of a roller coaster from taking over and sort of looking at how to build a team and who you're building a team with through the World Cup warm-ups into a World Cup where you come away with a bronze, into a Six Nations where working, and then suddenly the last two games, everyone is getting very, very excited. Do you feel now that you have begun to put the right pieces in place for this team to begin to get very, very, well, for the fans to get very, I'm using the word excited again, but have you got the pieces in place now to really start to kick on in the way that you want?
Yes, I think that this, the team is shaping in the way it needs to be. I talked about that consistency selection, the cohesion within the team. I think there's room over the next 3 years for some players to emerge. These players are going to be legacy players of this England team that are going to help this team over the next period of time and build through it. I sense that. I think the coaching team, we're always looking to keep developing as coaches. I think we've got the assistant coaches are really excellent coaches. I always reflect as a player, would I want to be coached by them? And I would want to be coached by them. And I was pretty discerning in terms of rating who I'd want to be coached by. Mm-hmm. I'd want to be coached by those coaches. I think the environment we've started to create, again, there's things that take time. Like I remember being stood up in front of the players in the camp ahead of this Six Nations, and I'd heard there was a bit of, you know, the guys were worried a bit about, you know, some of the newer players, worried about whether I got the right piece of kit on or whatever like that, and stood up in front of them in some ways. I really don't care. As long as you're wearing England kit and you guys can manage it and leaders will say what you wear, you guys manage that. I really just want you to go out and train hard, be the best you can be, and trying to create those habits where let's try and remove stress of things that don't matter and concentrate on the main thing, which is just moving forward as a rugby team. Though I have no doubt that over a period of time, I'll continue to have to ensure we keep capturing the lessons. There'll be bumps in the road, definitely. And I've shown, there's a diagram I show to the players regularly, which show about consistent growth and that consistency cycle, as opposed to just going up and down and up and down. And if we continue to do that, I think we've got good players. I think we've got good players who care a lot about this team. I think they're deep passionate about helping England win. And if we've got that, so good players who care and care coaches who are good coaches who care, then I think and pretty clear about where we're going to be and where rugby's going now, I think we've got an opportunity to grow.
Brilliant. Without wanting to give away a trade secret, we had a little pause halfway through and Steve put his microphone down and said, is this what people want? And I think hopefully England fans out there will A, have a much greater understanding of the man, and B, begin to get very quietly, not too many bells and whistles, we're not talking in hyperbole, but begin to get very excited about what the next few years might hold. Sum that up for us.
Yeah, look, 100%. I mean, it's not always essential to kind of share who you are, but I think when you're in a job like this, silence allows people to fill a vacuum. And I think what we've learned about is a very, 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 very passionate coach who cares about the player welfare, who has changed a lot of what England was about because it wasn't right for large sections, an environment where people want to be part of, that are dedicated and focused on getting better. And it's very rare that you speak, I think, especially this country, because we're overcoached about coaches not worrying about making mistakes. But as long as you keep doing what you're supposed to be doing, what we asked you to do, and don't play small. And I think for me, I couldn't be more excited. All the feedback I've ever had from the players is that it's a brilliant environment. Steve's a brilliant coach. We're heading in the right direction. Unfortunately, I think the best quote is, sometimes as a coach, you don't get enough time to tell everyone the story about what you're supposed to be doing because half the time you can't do it. Mm. And that, I think, is a great lesson for every fan and for every journalist. There is a plan. We are trying to do it. I haven't got the time, the will, or the desire, or the need to explain the minutiae to you, but trust me, we're in good hands. I think it's a really positive place, and I wish you the best of that, mate.
If you win in New Zealand, will you go into the post-match presser of the second test with hashtag believe in Steve on your shirt? Please. We'll get one made up for you.
Yeah.
That's a no. Was it as painful? Has it been all right? Some people say it's quite cathartic sometimes, or has it been a rock under the beach towel?
I love talking rugby. I enjoy talking to people who are passionate about it also, and passionate about English rugby, and just passionate about rugby in general. I want this game to thrive. I think we've got a responsibility to do that. So I'm grateful for the opportunity. I think, I'll stress you, the game's about players. Always has been. It's about the current players, and it's about the next players they're trying to inspire. you know, the kids, the little boys and girls to want to come into the game and thrive. That's what this game's about. It's, you know, we've had the privilege of playing at the highest level. Right now I get the opportunity to coach and try and help these players. You guys have the opportunity to keep trying to be positive and send positive messages about this great game of ours. But it's all about the players. So, you know, talking about myself, it's not why I would like to spend the vast majority of my time doing, clearly, because I'd rather talk about the players and I'd rather talk about the game than talk about myself.
I can think of one or two old coaches who disagree with you. Yeah, it's not just about the players, but it's been brilliant. Steve, thank you so much. Good luck for all that's to come. It's been a really enjoyable hour. Good luck, as we said, for all that's to come this summer.
Thank you very much.
Fantastic. Right, listen, just before we go, there is one note that we wanted to add to our show this week, and that was for the late Jim Henderson, who many of you will have read about over the last few weeks. Former Marine, a rugby player from Penryn in Cornwall, and an aid worker who was very tragically killed in Gaza 2 weeks ago. His club have put out a statement saying that we've lost one of the kindest, toughest, and most loyal players to have ever worn the Penryn shirt. Jim started playing for Penryn from the youth section all the way through to the seniors, where he was a force to be reckoned with. Jim commanded the back row with his relentless work ethic, which instilled on everyone that had the pleasure of playing beside him. And the reason we want to put this out is that his friends have put up a GoFundMe page for his family. So if you would like to donate, please search Marine James Henderson so that the rugby family can fully show their support. It's a desperately sad story, but hopefully as much money as possible can be raised via his GoFundMe page. That is it for this week's show. Hask, as always, a pleasure. Steve, thank you so much for coming on. Fascinating. Good luck for all that's to come. And really appreciate you joining us today. We've been the good, the bad, and the rugby with our friends at Continental Tires. Stats and facts provided by Oval Insight. We're a folding pocket production. And this episode was produced by Ollie Hunter. Thanks for joining us. And we'll see you again soon.
You've been listening to The Good, Yay, The Bad, and The Rugby. Oof. With Alex Payne, James Haskell, and Mike Tyndall. Thanks for listening.